Hi, I'm Jim DeLuccia, Communications Manager with the PICPA. Welcome to CPA Conversations, PICPA's podcast series, where we'll talk to CPAs and other professionals about pressing matters affecting the accounting industry. Today we're going to conduct a bit of a book review because who doesn't like a good story? Narrative and Numbers, The Value of Stories in Business by Aswath Damodaran, a leader in the business valuation world, was released earlier this year, and CPAs and other professionals working in this industry have once again found great value in his findings. Chuck London, CPA, and a partner with Beederson LLP, joins me to provide his review, and he will actually speak at greater length on Damodaran's work at PICPA's 2017 Valuation and Forensic and Accounting Conference on November 2nd. Chuck, thanks for joining me on the phone today.
Thanks, Jim.
So I know this may seem self-explanatory based on the title of the book, The Value of Stories in Business, but you know, could you kind of briefly explain what is the basic concept of this book?
Sure. The basic concept is that in the valuation profession, the narrative, the story, is just as important as getting the numbers right. And the way that Dr. Damodaran describes it, he describes it as a tale of two tribes. And he says that when we start out, we are either number crunchers, we've perfected our analytical abilities, or we are storytellers. And he offers the hypothesis that this separation occurs essentially in middle school, and that there's a natural division. And on one side, he's got what he calls the quants. Those are people that specialize in the quantification of things. And on the other side are the poets. And I think back to the movie Margin Call. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's a great business story about the collapse of the securities markets in mortgage-backed securities in 2008. And the two stars are Jeremy Irons and Kevin Spacey on the one side, and Zachary Quinto on the other side as the rocket scientist. He is literally a PhD in rocket science that goes to Wall Street, and he studies numbers. And he realizes that the volatility of the mortgage-backed securities has gotten so unstable that the market is going to crash and it's going to wipe out the earnings of the firm. And the contrast is that Jeremy Irons, who plays the managing director of the firm, is essentially a storyteller. And he says that it's his job to listen to the music, and when the music stops, it's his call to decide essentially to bail out of the mortgage-backed securities interest, and that leads to the financial collapse in 2008. And so I think that's a great story that explains the difference between storytellers and number crunchers.
Wow.
As accountants, we tend to focus on the left side of our brain. Storytellers tend to focus on the right side of their brain. I've heard that described sometimes as hard skills versus soft skills. And as CPAs, we get lots of training in the hard number analysis, but we don't get near as much training on the softer skills. And that's why I was attracted to this book. Dr. Damodaran describes valuation as the bridge between these two worlds. And the way he builds on this premise is that he describes a five-step process to understand how to do a strong valuation that reflects the strength of the numbers and the strength of the story. Step one, he posits, is developing a narrative for the business that you're valuing. He says that in the narrative, we should tell the story about how we see the business evolving over time. Because the one thing we can agree upon is that change is constant. In step two, he says that we ought to test the narrative to see if it's possible, if it's plausible, and finally, if it's probable. He points out that there are lots of possible narratives, but not all of them are plausible, and only a few of them are probable. Next, he suggests that we convert the narrative into drivers of value. I think all business valuation professionals would agree that one of the things that we have to accomplish when we set out to value a business is to understand what is it that drives the value of the business. he suggests that we take the narrative apart and look at how we can translate it into valuation inputs, starting with the potential market size, moving on to the cash flows, focusing on the risk, and by the time we're done, each part of the narrative should have a place in the numbers, and each number should be backed up with a portion of the story. In step four, he talks about connecting the drivers of the value to the valuation, that we ought to create an intrinsic valuation model that connects the inputs to the end value in the business. That's probably more on the analytical side that we're all familiar with. But what I found incredibly insightful is his suggestion in step five to keep the feedback loop open. That is to say that we ought to listen to people who know the business better than we do and use their suggestions to fine-tune the narrative and perhaps even alter it. We should work out the effects of the value of alternative narratives for the company. And as he describes how to apply this process, he has a number of case studies. Now, these case studies are not necessarily deep dives, but rather they talk about a number of popular, well-known companies that have had what I would characterize as valuation challenges. And because Dr. DeMoterin is a professor at the Stern School at New York University, and active on blogs, and active in podcasts, and he's featured regularly in lots of national conferences for a number of different institutions, not just CPAs. He's in a position to comment frequently on public companies, and especially when they initially go public, and what he thinks the underlying value of that organization is. And one of the stories that he talks about is Uber, and I think we'll get into that a little more in the conference. But he talks about how he's constantly trying to reassess his estimates, and he listens to others. I think one of the most powerful things in his book is a concept that I've heard expressed elsewhere, but not nearly so clearly, and that is his idea of something called a corporate life cycle. And I think this can be applied to any public company or any private company, because fundamentally every company is going to go through the different stages in the corporate life cycle. And he's got a chart that we'll share during the conference that describes different growth stages. In stage one, the company might be in startup mode. In stage two, it might be a young growth company that's created a business model. It's in the process of converting ideas into potential revenues and earnings. In stage three, it's in high growth mode. That's when they're building the business and converting the potential into actual revenues. Stage four, he describes as the midlife crisis. And that's when it's in a mature growth phase. The business has grown. It's shifted from losses to profits. And I would guess that maybe half of the valuations that we do as professionals are either in stage four, the mature growth, or stage five, the mature and stable situation. And in stage five, we're defending our business from new competitors and we're trying to find new markets. And then occasionally, we'll get an assignment where we're valuing a company that's in stage six, the decline. It's past the point where it's entered into the end game, and the business is scaling down because the market is shrinking. And I think this protocol can be used to measure all businesses, and we ought to have a clear understanding exactly where our subject company fits in this corporate life cycle. And that's all part of a story, and stories can be powerful. When I think back on my own career, and as I've worked with different litigators, typically there is great power in telling stories during summation when you're trying to persuade a jury of a certain point. I can think of one case where I was involved where the plaintiff had an oral agreement essentially to sell his business to a much larger public company. And it's a typical David versus Goliath story. The plaintiff's attorney was trying to persuade the jury the Goliath company had taken undue advantage and had intentionally suggested that they acquire my client and then stripped out all the intellectual property and left him with nothing. And there was one email in the course of thousands of emails that went back and forth between the parties where one of the defendants printed out the email, sent it to an associate that said, hey, the person on the other side has food poisoning, period. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, period. And although those two sentences didn't really have a lot of bearing on the dispute, the attorney was able to capsulize it into a soundbite. And the last question he asked the corporate defendant when he was on the stand was, you were sincere when you meant that, weren't you, that it couldn't happen to a nicer guy? And then after the jury returned an award of several million dollars, my friend, the attorney, got an opportunity to interview the jury. And they said when they got back in the jury room to begin the deliberation process, three of the jurors were businessmen. And they decided the liability issues in about 2 minutes. And they turned to each other and said, couldn't happen to a nicer guy. There's incredible power in those kinds of stories because we remember them. And one of the things Dr. Demoderin does is describe the science, the neuroscience, that occurs when we make a connection to a good, well-told story, and it triggers oxycontin. And when we look at the chemical process in the brain that triggers memory, we find that when stories are well told, there's a neuroscience explanation for what goes on. And it's part of that connection that helps us to retain the story and remember it 40 years later.
So, Chuck, you mentioned a couple real life stories here, and that was one of the questions I had for you was, and you mentioned Uber. I know you actually talked a little bit about Margin Call, which I have not seen. And it sounds like something I might want to check out since I know there's some pretty good actors in it. But what's one real life story the author shared that, you know, kind of surprised you?
Sure, I'll give you two examples. In one instance, he talks about trying to value Ferrari. Ferrari is a car company that's at the very high end. And although it sells a limited number of cars each year, it sells might only be 3,000 a year, they're extraordinarily high end. And because there isn't a lot of competition on the high end of the market, their margins are well above everyone else in their peer. And initially, when the company went public, he valued the company as an automobile company. And he thought that the value was significantly lower than the initial public offering price. And one day, he happened to be on a plane, and he's leafing through the duty-free articles in the back of the magazine that's part of the airline package, and he finds advertisements for duty-free purchases of Ferrari watches and Ferrari pens. And a light bulb goes on at that moment, and he realizes that Ferrari isn't just an automobile brand, but rather it has brand appeal that extends into areas outside of the automobile industry. And it's at that point that he realizes he's made an error in his valuation. And he goes on his blog, redoes his valuation, and he comes much closer to what the initial pricing model suggested in the IPO. The same thing occurs with the Uber story. In the Uber story, when he first values Uber on the basis of one of its private offerings right before the initial public offering, he has a limited understanding of what the Uber marketplace is. And he describes the possible market as the car ownership market. And he thinks that that might be somewhere in the $2 billion range. He thinks it's plausible that where the company's going to have the greatest success is in the suburban car service and rental market. And he thinks that's going to grow at about 6% a year. And he thinks the probable market
the sweet spot, the target market, is the urban taxi market, which he measures at $100 billion. Now, it turns out that although he's articulated a well-thought-out strategy that he publishes in his blog, that there's a response from one of the investors and board members of Uber, a gentleman by the name of Bill Gurley, and he has an opportunity to point out what he thinks are the fundamental flaws in the Motorin's approach. And he says, we're not really an urban taxi market. We're the sweet spot, the probable spot, is our logistics market, and that's a $300 billion market. It's plausible that this concept will extend into mass transit and non-users, and we think that's substantially larger than just a suburban car service area. And we quantify the possible marketplace as the car ownership market, which we think is a $10 billion market, substantially higher than the $2 to $3 billion market range that DeMotorin had. And after digesting the critique of his opinion, again, DeMotorin says, I need to have an open feedback loop. I need to consider, are there other pieces of information that I may not have had in my analysis? That's step five in his five-step approach. And so he'll go back and say, you know what? I've rethought my assumptions. I've rethought the significance of the story, and I've now changed my opinion of value. And so those are real-life examples that he describes in his book about the benefits of keeping an open feedback loop.
Now, as someone like yourself who's, you know, worked extensively in business valuation, what was one principle of the book that particularly stood out to you that you may have not considered before?
I would say that it's the impact of a global marketplace. In my practice, the vast majority of the instances where I'm asked to do evaluation, I'm focusing on U.S. impact. And as I look at the broader market, I find that that's not necessarily the case. It may have been the case 20 years ago. It was certainly the case 40 years ago. When I started in the accounting profession, unquestionably, New York City was the center of the global finance marketplace. We raised 80% of the funds. U.S. GAAP was the generally world-accepted standard of measure of economic performance. And so there wasn't any bias in ignoring the other 20% of the market. As time has gone on, there's been a general switch to recognizing the significance of global marketplaces. And that's translated into lower cost of capital at the global level. And so, for instance, when we talk about Ferrari, their weighted average cost of capital is only 8% because they have the ability to access capital markets outside of the U.S., and their transactional costs are much lower, the cost of funds is lower, the expectations about inflation are different. And all of that means that they're able to raise funds at a much lower rate, which means their multiples are a lot higher. And that was certainly something that I hadn't focused on. And I think as more U.S. companies expand their global footprints, we'll need to take into account whether or not some of the companies that we're valuing will have opportunities to take advantage of more attractive rates in different currencies and therefore change our estimates about the cost of capital.
Okay. So, you know, obviously you have a lot of, you know, high regard for this book, and there's certainly, from my research, there's been a lot of, you know, great reviews about it. But what is perhaps maybe one concept that was outlined in Narrative and Numbers, The Value of Stories in Business, that perhaps maybe you don't agree with or feel maybe it isn't applicable when working in business valuation?
I would say it's pretty much what we just talked about, and that is the emphasis on global markets.
Okay.
I think for most of the practitioners in the Pennsylvania Institute of CPAs, we're focused on advising companies that are small and medium-sized enterprises that may not have access to these global opportunities, number one. Number two, they're not going to have the same opportunity for feedback in public markets. I think, you know, the vast number of assignments that that practitioners in Pennsylvania get are for closely held companies. And so they can't look to public markets as a sanity check to see whether or not the value expectations that we've articulated are confirmed by the marketplace. Nonetheless, when we talk about the corporate life cycle model, those descriptions about the forces that affect all private companies are just as applicable. And so there are large parts of the Motorin's book that are applicable to valuation practitioners.
Now lastly, why should CPAs working in business valuations pay close attention to this book?
Jim, that's a great question. When we look at the mission of the Pennsylvania Institute of Certified Public Accountants, especially on the education side, that mission is that we're trying to refine skills and expand knowledge. And one of the reasons I like this book so much is that it does exactly that. It helps us to refine our skills, expand our knowledge. And I would say that Dr. DeMotorin is one of the thought leaders in the valuation profession. He's written a lot of books. He's written a lot of blogs. The work that he did in 2008, I think, changed a lot of thinking among professionals about the supply side equity risk premium. It's certainly something that I've adapted in my practice. And his book ends on a positive note. He points out that if all we have are stories, but we can't back up those stories with numbers, we're left with fairy tales. On the other side of the equation, if all we have are numbers that we can't connect to stories, then all we've accomplished is an exercise in financial modeling. But when we build a valuation that bridges both the numbers and the story, we add value. And he starts out acknowledging his own bias as a number cruncher. He agrees that he had to work at improving his storytelling capabilities. But he points out that with practice, this A, gets easier, and B, it's fun. And so I think he's got lessons not only for those of us in the valuation profession, but also for those of us that are making investments, so that when we put our investor hats on, there are things we can learn from his book. And the same thing applies for entrepreneurs, business owners, and managers. They can all benefit from the lessons that he puts forth in his book.
Well, it sounds really interesting, Chuck, and I really appreciate you sharing this insight with our audience today.
It's my privilege.
And again, for your listeners out there, Chuck is going to get into even more detail on this topic at our PICPA's 2017 Valuation and Forensic Accounting Conference on November 2nd. You can register to attend in person at the DoubleTree by Hilton in King of Prussia, or via our webcast at www.picpa.org/conferences. I also want to mention that we are building a library of CPA conversations. Check them out at www.picpa.org/conversations. Or make it easy on yourself by subscribing at the Apple iTunes Store or Google Play. And of course, make sure to pass along your ideas for podcasts at communications@picpa.org. Talk to you later, everyone.